sales win rates have plummeted to a mere 17%, and outdated technology and tedious manual processes are to blame. Meanwhile, managers lack the visibility they need to hold their teams accountable. But imagine a world in which these crippling issues are solved automatically. Revenue.io automates the most frustrating parts of sales so reps can focus on what they do best, selling. Completely automate pre-call research, logging conversation data in your CRM, writing post-conversation recap emails, and prioritized outreach. And as reps book more meetings and close more deals, managers gain the real-time insight they need to scale what's working across their entire team. Ready to say goodbye to tedious sales processes and watch your win rate soar? Head over to revenue.io to learn more.
I can extend my curiosity. I can ask great questions. I can listen carefully. I can help them identify what the real challenge is, enroll them in coming up with ideas for what is the best solution, help them define what their options are for how they want to solve it. You're more likely to get a positive outcome from that approach than selling the bits and bytes.
Yeah, there's something that may potentially happen along the way, which is you actually help them understand the problem in a whole new way. It's bigger, it's deeper, it's more profound, it's shifted off to the left. That in itself is the win. Now you're like, these people helped me figure out what was really going on.
Hi, friends. Welcome back to the Sales Enablement Podcast. I'm your host, Andy Paul. Now, that was Michael Bungay Stanier. Michael's the author of one of my favorite books, The Coaching Habit, and he's the author of a brand new book titled The Advice Trap. Be humble, stay curious, and change the way you lead forever. And Michael's joining me today on Sales Enablement, episode 771, to talk about the three main problems with giving advice. One is your advice doesn't work. Two, you're oftentimes trying to solve the wrong problem with that advice. And three, the solution you propose is most often pretty mediocre. So as a result, you risk becoming what Michael calls an advice monster. So we're going to dig into what it means for a manager or leader to become an advice monster and get into what the consequences are for both the advice receivers as well as the advice givers. And we'll dive into some concrete steps you can take to effectively coach and give advice. All that and much more. But before we get to Michael, I want to let you know that the whole team of people who work to produce this podcast are incredibly grateful for all of you who support us by listening to the show, telling your friends, sharing it on social media, and most importantly, subscribing to this show and giving us your feedback in the form of a rating and review. So thank you very much. All right, let's jump into it. Michael, welcome back to the show.
Andy, it is good to be back. The newly refreshed, newly decorated, same new wallpaper, but same awesome infrastructure type of podcast. I love it.
Yes, much better wallpaper. That's a great way to put it than we had before. And a beautiful new name as well. So exactly. Yeah, nice to have you back. You were your third time. You're in the sort of elite strata of guests.
I know. Are we going to have anything to talk about? I don't know. We might have to make light entertaining a thing. I could run you through my stand-up comedy routine.
Well, I think we can try to leave some time at the end for that. But we do have a new book from you to talk about.
We do.
Which, people listen to the show know that I'm a, I'm a fanboy, basically, of Michael Bungay Stanier.
Thank you.
And the first book, The Coaching Habit, which is a fabulous book, and not just for people that are interested in becoming more effective coaches. As I tell people, it's also one of the great sales books because the process you use to coach is pretty similar to the process you should use to sell.
You know, I was in the Ring DNA's sales book, bracket playoffs, and I got knocked out by Phil Jones, who's a friend of mine, so I feel a bit resentful about that. And then he got knocked out by Keith Ferrazzari, who is also a friend of mine, so I'm like, all right, so at least I'm getting knocked out by people I know.
Yeah, well, we need to get Phil on the show. He's not been on it yet, but so the new book is called, and it's really a sort of follow-on, a companion piece, a playbook, if you will, for The Coaching Habit, called The Advice Trap. Be humble, stay curious, and change the way you lead forever. And you did another good job with it again. You're one of these people who make me feel inadequate when I read things that you've written compared to what I write myself. So thank you for that. Keep me motivated.
Well, let me ask you, let me be nosy and go, so what is it about the book that gives you that reaction? I know you're saying it partly in jest, but why does it make you feel inadequate?
Because you do such a good job of writing what I tried to do, which is just take the complex and make it simple. And I think this is so important because it's so easy to make things overly complex, and so much of what people try to describe in the sales world is just that. I mean, yeah, there's lots of science behind the way people think and make decisions and the way that we approach people and engage, but you can also simplify it to some really core concepts, which you've done, which I try to do, and just make it easy for people to access the material.
Well, I think that's the key. That's a key insight, and that's really worth hearing for the folks listening in, which is that ability to move, simplicity on the other side of complexity, as somebody once said, is extremely powerful if you can move it to that. And I do it by just rewriting and rewriting and rewriting. These books of mine, which are relatively short and hopefully are a relatively easy read, only get there by being longer and crappier through many drafts before I finally make it sound like I effortlessly just dashed it off overnight. But I do also think that it's one of the kind of meta skills that if you're in the world of sales, which is to be able to bring your prospect or bring your customer or your partner to a place where they're finding elegance, that simplicity on the other side of complexity, it moves you into a type of relationship with them that moves beyond the transactional, I'm pushing tin, to you're actually helping me see the world in a different way. And that's a powerful place to be.
Exactly. Exactly. And yeah, thanks to you, and you and I share some resources we use to produce and publish our books. Yeah. I'm sitting there all week when I was reading your book, I was like, oh yeah, I'm starting over again. So yeah. Amanda, if you're listening, I'm sorry.
Yeah. But you're working with Amanda, our co-editor. Yeah,
a lot of rewriting coming down the path. But it'll be better because So all right, so let's start. What is the advice trap?
Well, the coaching habit has been this amazing success, and just as you said in the intro, it's not really written for people who are already coaches, although that's a big part of the people who buy it. Yes. It's really written for normal people, if you want to put it like that. People who are in the world of interacting with other human beings. Because the fundamental belief of the coaching habit is being more coach-like, which boils down to, can you stay curious a little bit longer? Can you rush to action and advice giving a little bit more slowly? Is a powerful way to have better conversations and better relationships. And, that book has sold, I think it's about 800,000 copies now, which is, amazing.
Amazing, right?
It is truly extraordinary. I'm still kind of thrilled by it every time I realize that. And I get emails and messages all the time from people going, you know what? I picked up the 7 questions. I started using them. And, it's changed. It's changed the way I sell, as coach, parent, all sorts of things. And I love that. But Andy, there's also a bunch of people who picked up the book, read it, went, it's well written or not, it's funny or not. I get the 7 questions in theory. In practice, I'm finding it really hard to shift my behavior, to be more curious. Even though I get it, in practice, I find it really hard to shift. And I bet you this happens all the time in sales because, I'm not a sales expert, but I know enough to say, the rookie mistake that people make in sales is they try and sell too fast. They're like, I've got a thing. Let me try and tell you about my thing. As opposed to going, you've got a problem. What's going on for you? And maybe I have a solution for you. Maybe I don't, but maybe I do.
Right.
And even though we all know this, I mean, there's not a single person listening to this podcast who doesn't know that in theory. In practice, I bet you there's a bunch of guilty people out there going, yeah, you know what? Now you mention it, I do start to push my solution a little too soon.
Yeah. Well, prescribe before they diagnose.
Yeah, exactly.
And that is one of the typical faults of sellers. But also, as we're going to speak about it, it is a particular problem of managers and sales leaders who are trying to coach the people that work for them.
Yes.
And so this is one of the big trends that, has occurred in sales over the last year, somewhat driven by the technology that's come into sales, is everything's become more prescriptive and formulaic.
Mm-hmm.
And as a consequence, we've lost sight of this the human aspect of it, which your books do such a great job of emphasizing, both from coaching people to realize their own potential, as well as working in a similar fashion with your buyers.
Yeah. And the third beneficiary of this, because if you're able to introduce this kind of concept of being more coach-like in the way you interact, sure, it benefits the people you're managing and leading and trying to make better coaches or better salespeople. Sure, it benefits your prospects, so you're likely to make more sales and have better relationships. But the other thing you've got to remember is being more coach-like helps you have a better life.
Yes.
It helps you work a little less hard and have more impact in the work that you do, because you're not busy trying to solve other people's problems, to have all the answers, to rescue all the people, to keep control of all the uncontrollable stuff. You actually understand how to move responsibility and accountability and growth and empowerment and confidence and competence to the level where it belongs, mm-hmm. which is out of your hands and out of your head and into the hands and heads of the people that you're working with.
Well, I think one of the common themes between the books is, yeah, if you're implementing this, both as the giver as well as the recipient, is to make people just better human beings.
Yeah.
And I think if you can do that, that translates into benefits in whatever role you play in your career, whether it's a seller or a manager or something completely outside sales.
Yeah. You know, I founded a company called Box of Crayons, which is a learning and development company, works in big organizations typically, and helps them move from advice-driven to curiosity-led. So, you know, mm-hmm. our clients are Salesforce and Microsoft and other folks like that. Which is awesome. But I also, now I stopped being the CEO of that company. Another team runs that company now, which is fabulous. They do a much better job. I'm not a great, I'm
yeah,
a terrible
Shannon,
CEO.
Shannon's not the CEO, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Shannon Minifee is our brilliant CEO, and she has a brilliant leadership team. And in fact, everybody, I mean, I love this company. But I'm also, Andy, in this kind of moment going, well, who am I now outside Box of Crayons? Because I wore that identity for almost 20 years. I mean, you know, with your new partnership with RingDNA, you might have been going through a similar thing. Who am I now? How's mm-hmm, that shifted?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I've been going, what? So my new venture, which is MBS.works, which is a sandbox for me to play in. But I'm like, what do I stand for in this world? And I'm still experimenting, but currently I'm playing with this idea of be curious, be courageous, and be the best version of yourself.
Yes.
And that's all coming around to this piece that you're saying, which is like, actually, this helps people fulfill their potential. And it means that you get to create some of the space in your own life to fulfill your own potential as well.
Yeah. And I this is a theme I address in my writing. I got an acronym that came called just BVOY, which is, you know, best version of yourself.
I love
which,
that.
Which is what, if you can accomplish that in any dimension, it's going to benefit all the other dimensions in your life. And that's,
yeah.
And if you come at it through reading a book like yours or getting an insight to something you're doing in a sales perspective that enables you to be more authentic in the connections you make with people and so on, who cares where it comes from?
Yeah.
So,
well, how do you make the link between BVOY, be the best version of yourself, and the elite people in the world of sales?
Well, I think for the most part, they are, right? I think mm-hmm. that's one of the secrets to their success. So if I look at my own career and had yeah. fortune to have great success in sales and even before starting my own company, and then the companies I've worked with supporting them to success is, for me, it all starts with that connection, you know, that human connection. Yeah. And I look at sales sort of this, you know, logical progression of things that happens, and not as a sales process, but it is as a recognition that if I don't do a good job establishing that first initial connection and building the rapport, building the trust, it doesn't matter what follows. If I don't do a good job, everything that follows is diminished as a result yeah. of that. And it doesn't, yeah. doesn't mean the customer is not going to continue to talk with me. But as I like to say, from that moment forward, if I don't do a good job, I'm fighting for second place. Mm-hmm. And in sales, second place gets you nothing.
Right.
There's no consolation prize. And the difference between winning and losing is always, you should always assume it's just 1%.
Yeah.
And so how do I start gaining that 1% edge? Well, it's just being me and making these connections. And I've been, before starting my own company years ago, but I mean, spent 25 years selling really complex technical products without any technical background at all, mm-hmm. other than what I'd learned, self-taught. But if in that environment, how to succeed, you know, every time I went back and analyzed it, it started with those connections. Right. It didn't finish with the connections, but started with the connections.
Yeah.
And yeah, trying not to be, well, it's just fun reading the book because it's the things you talk about is trying not to be what you called an advice monster, which right. took experience to learn that my job wasn't to impose my beliefs on the customer and my recommendations on the customer, but to help them find that path themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think if you wanted to give this new book, The Advice Trap, a hashtag, it would boil down to tame your advice monster, which was, you know, it was a single line in The Coaching Habit, and probably the line that gets tweeted and mentioned most often, where people go, oh my God, I have an advice monster. I'm like, yes, you do. And you know what? Almost everybody does. And if you're not sure, I mean, to the people who are listening, if you're not sure whether you have your advice monster, here's a test. Somebody starts talking. And even though you don't know that person particularly well, even though you don't really know the context that they're talking about or the other people involved or really the nuances of the situation or the technical specifications or the cultural context, nonetheless, after about 10 seconds, there's something in your head and you're like, I've got something to tell you. I'm going to add some value to this conversation. Here I go. And if you've ever experienced that moment, and I know you have,
then you've got
an advice monster, as do we all.
Yes.
And it turns out so much of coaching is, it's not just what you do, it's also what you don't do. You know, and if The Coaching Habit says, here's what to do, here are the 7 questions that can lay a foundation for you to be much more coach-like and much more effective. The flip side, the what you have to not do is not let your advice monster wander loose. You got to tame your advice monster.
Right. And so you define 3 personas for mm-hmm. the advice monster. And as I was going through these, and we'll talk about here is yeah, you know, in some cases, these roles are institutionalized in the job description.
Sure. Pretty much.
So you have 3 personas: tell it, save it, control it. So tell us about those 3.
Yeah, well, I just want to absolutely agree with you that there's a way of behaving that is institutionalized. So in the act of being more coach-like and the act of taming your advice monster, in many organizations, you're being countercultural. So mm-hmm. it's worth recognizing that that situation that you might find yourself in. So yeah, 3 advice monsters: tell it, save it, and control it. Tell it, the noisiest of the 3, has convinced you that the way you add value, and really the only way you add value, is to have all the answers. I mean, you need to have all the answers to all the things, and you need to have them all the time. You need to have all the answers to all the things all the time. And if you don't have all those answers, then you are going to fail. Then you are failing. You are failing those around you.
That's the perception, not the reality. Yeah,
that's
right.
That's the perception. That's what your advice monster is telling you. Your advice monster is telling you, if you don't have the answers, you know, what's wrong with you?
And this is one of the roles I was talking about that's become institutionalized. So if having this conversation more and more with people about, you know, you look at the role of a senior sales leader, a VP of sales, a CRO, even a director level, is the perception is that, yeah, they are that person that's supposed to have all the answers. And
it's ludicrous.
And it's ludicrous, and it's archaic in the way we structure that role.
Yeah.
And it puts these people in a bind because then they become reluctant to ask for help because suddenly they're seen as less than if they ask for help.
You know, I'm going to lay out the 3 reasons why your advice goes wrong, and it's particularly prevalent with the talent advice monster. Mm-hmm. So look, the first is this, and I kind of implied it before, which is honestly, you don't even know what the problem is. In fact, the other person who's talking to you doesn't really know what the problem is either. At the start of a conversation, you're both finding your way to try and figure out what the real problem is. And you just both think you know. But honestly, it's a fair bet that almost every time the first challenge that shows up is never the real challenge. And if you launch yourself into trying solving that initial challenge, you're just wasting your time because you're solving the wrong problem.
And this relates to sales directly too. Yeah, because I tell people when I work with sellers is, yeah, don't accept the first thing they say because a buyer says at face value.
Yeah. The way I frame this, and this might be really helpful for those all of you listening in the sales community, is you become a much more valued part of an ecosystem when you become brilliant at figuring out what the real challenge is.
Right.
Rather than the person who happens to have the answer. Because, and this is the second reason, number one, you don't know what the problem is. Number two, your advice is not nearly as good as you think it is. I mean, honestly, it's mostly out of date. It's a bit random. The only bits that are really tested are the stuff that I can look up on Google, and I can get a much better answer much faster than from you. And you have these cognitive biases that get in the way of you even understanding how bad your advice is. And in fact, there's an irony, which is the more quietly confident you are about how awesome your advice is, the more likely it is that your advice is not that great. So you're in this paradox. I mean, there's this thing called the Dunning-Kruger
Dunning-Kruger effect, they call it, I think.
Yeah, Dunning-Kruger effect. Thank you. And the way I heard it described, which is outstanding, which is stupid people are too stupid to realize that they're stupid.
Yes, I think that. Well, it's a little harsh, but yeah,
that is totally a little harsh. But it basically means that if you're thinking I'm pretty smart, there's a fair chance you're not as good as you think you are.
Exactly. Yeah, you're overconfident, and the downside becomes is you become stuck in that paradigm. You stop learning.
Yeah.
And so to your point is your advice that you start giving them becomes outdated.
So those are the first two reasons that your advice can go bad. You're trying to solve the wrong problem. And then even if you've got the right problem, your advice actually isn't that great. But even if, and this is the kind of crucial moment really, even if A, you're really clear on what the real problem is, and B, you actually have a genius solution. I mean, it's really good. It's gold dust. It's a pearl of wisdom. You then get to this third moment, which is what's the right act of leadership? Because you're at this crossroads. And one of them is you go down the first choice, which is you just give them the answer. You're like, here it is. Here's the answer. Go do it. And there is a time and a place for exactly that behavior. Don't get me wrong. This is not anti-advice. Mm-hmm. It's anti-defaulting to advice giving being your default response.
Right.
And there are some times where you're like, the thing for me to do right now is to give you the answer. But you have another choice, and it's a choice. It's the road less taken, and it's a road that is often more powerful, which is you go, let me help you figure out the answer here. Let me hold the space. I'm going to make sure you don't walk out of here without some right action to take. You know, I've got your back, but if I spend 2 minutes, 3 minutes, maybe as long as 5 minutes, just helping you figure this out, you will probably come up with a good enough answer. It might not be as good as your brilliant answer. Certainly, that's what your cognitive bias will tell you. But it's a fair bet they're going to come up with a half-decent answer a bunch of times. Mm-hmm. And in that act of saying, let me ask you some questions, let me ask you, what's the real challenge here for you? You empower them. You help them become more aware, more competent, more confident, more autonomous, more self-sufficient. And, you know, this isn't really trading short-term wins against long-term wins. It's trading a short-term loss against an almost immediate short to medium-term win, which is you've got better, smarter, more confident people on your team who don't feel the need to come to you every time for one of your wrong answers. Everybody's going to win in a situation like that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and this is, again, this is one of these dual lessons apply. Yeah. And I follow up with a question on this afterwards about coaching itself is yeah, you develop people that have the ability to more readily define the problem that they're trying to solve and yep. have the wherewithal to address it.
Exactly.
And you want to think about it from a customer perspective. That's exactly what you want your customers to be able to do. You can come in and say, look, this is the solution, right?
Yep.
We've got it. And what you're doing at that point is you're just selling bits and bytes.
Yep.
Where the other direction is, yeah, I can extend my curiosity. I can ask great questions. I can listen carefully. I can help them identify what the real challenge is, enroll them in coming up with ideas for what is the best solution, help mm-hmm. them define what their options are for how they want to solve it. You're more likely to get a positive outcome from that approach than selling the bits and bytes.
Yeah, and there's something that may potentially happen along the way, which is you actually help them understand the problem in a whole new way.
Yes.
It's bigger, it's deeper, it's more profound, it's shifted off to the left. And that in itself is the win. Like now you're like, these people helped me figure out what was really going on. Do I want to hire you again, or do I want to give my business to the guy who tried to, the gal who tried to sell me the stuff as she always does? You're always going to come out ahead of that.
Yeah.
You know, Andy, there's a guy, a person you should get on this podcast. His new book, which is from Harvard Business Review, is called "What's Your Problem?" And he's a Danish man, Thomas Wedelsborg, I think. He's got a name even more complicated than mine. I mean, Andy Paul, you're at one entire end of the spectrum of name complexity. With Michael Bungay Stanier.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
Michael Bungay Stanier, you're pretty close to the other end. But Thomas Wedelsborg is like, he goes, takes it to 11. But the whole book, and it's a really great book, it's pretty new out in the world, is about learning the art of reframing.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you learn to reframe the problem, you learn to control your destiny.
Right.
And that's part of what we're saying here, which is like when you rush to the action and the advice and the solution, you haven't taken the moment to reframe the conversation. And by, you know, it's like an axiom in politics. When you frame the situation, you control the conversation.
Right. Well, I wanted to ask this question about coaching, because specifically in the sales world, there's this broad range of definitions of what coaching is. Right. And increasingly, it's very transactional.
Mm-hmm.
I need help on strategizing what to do about this deal.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I've got some specific, you know, we're listening to a recorded phone call and I want you to listen to that and help me. And so instead of, it becomes very prescriptive, you know, the coaches themselves have their advice monster, which they willingly yes. bring out into the open.
Yeah.
And it's less about, yeah, how do I help these people? Because it seems more expeditious to solve it for them rather than give them the tools to learn how to solve it going forward and become self-coached.
Yeah, if you want to be blunt about it, there's often an inherent conflict of interests in the business model of coaching. And this is like whether you're a paid, you know, executive, external coach, or even if you're just an internal coach, which is if you can make people codependent on you, that's awesome. It's just not that awesome in terms of how do I, you know, help people be the best version of themselves? How do I create people who are autonomous and confident and competent, all those things I was talking about before? And, you know, it's you wouldn't want to put this down to malice, not entirely, because there's all sorts of pressure from their organization around driving success and driving behavior change and the like. It's just it's a bit naive, it's a bit short-sighted, and it doesn't actually work that well because you just create dependence rather than a sense of autonomy.
Right. And I think, but one of the key problems is that the coaching increasingly is geared towards, look, we have this technology. We can you know, listen to the phone calls. We can use AI mm-hmm. to analyze the phone calls and so on. And what we want to do is use this technology and use this coaching to have you be like this idealized individual
right.
who does these things the right way, which is probably, you know, a compilation of traits from a variety of people. So it's always about, you know, we want to coach you to become this model thing
yes.
as opposed to being the best version of you.
Yeah. Well, it's the best version of you is always in a context. And you've got to understand and play to the context. So, you know, if you decide the best version of you is a naked oil painter, then that's not going to work in a context of many organizations where you're trying to be a successful salesperson.
Right.
So it is a fair question to say, right, how do I give you the tools and how do I introduce you to structures and processes that will enable you to be the best version of you using tools that are the best processes and sales tools to be successful? And, you know, this is a generic answer, I realize, but, you know, you're always looking for that balance, which is how much structure and how much play, you know, how much process and how much personality.
And
yeah, that's the nice balance, which is how much process, how much personality.
Yeah.
And there's no magic answer to that other than asking the question, do we have the right balance between process and personality? And if I had to put money on it, and I think this is what you're saying too, Andy, which is to say probably because of organizations' hunger to control.
Yes, that's exactly what I was going
to say. You're like, we're just trying to it'd be great if we could just eliminate human error from the system, by which mean you'd be great if we could eliminate humans from the system. You know, I'll give you another great book that I've been reading lately and loving. It's called Brave New Work by a guy called Aaron Dignan, Dignan. And he is working with lots of organizations, some big, some small. And he's saying, look, the organization of the future, and by the future, he means now.
Yeah. Future's been accelerated.
Yeah, exactly. Has two core attributes. They are people positive and they are complexity conscious.
Mm-hmm.
So you realize that your people are essential. That is your organization. It is your people. You've got to go, how do I bring out the very best of my people? And it's also realizing that organizations are complex systems. They're not complicated. Complicated is kind of like essentially machine-like. Mm-hmm. You know, you press a lever or pull a lever and something will pop out that you're expecting at the other end. A complex system says actually it doesn't work like that. They operate less by rules than by principles. And the organizations that will thrive in the future, certainly, I mean, you can make an argument about this, but let's just say the organizations that will thrive in the future, and certainly the organizations that I'm interested in trying to help create, mm-hmm. are those ones that have a complexity awareness and are people positive. And
right.
That's what will allow you to find the balance between personality and process.
Yeah, and that's a great way of phrasing it too, because there's a American business thinker from the 1920s, I forget who the name, but basically saying that, yeah, you know, methods, you know, processes basically are a dime a dozen.
Yeah.
Principles are few.
Yeah.
And the principle driven organization is more likely to succeed. And I've been always struck by that, because I think that's right on, because you are saying, okay, it's not like you don't have a process, not like you don't have a structure, but how do you enable people to operate within, you know, these series of constraints, which may not be tightly binding, but give them structure.
Yeah. And the way you do it is you help them be better learners. And coaching, of course, is a outstanding technology to help people learn, because it builds into it awareness and commitment, error feedback, and it has the assumption of kind of repetition in that. And you know, I keep throwing books at people. This is a bit more of a kind of a technical book, but by a neuroscientist called Stanislaus, what's his name? Stanislaus somebody. It's called How We Learn. And it's like he is a neuroscientist who at the very edge of education. And it's mostly about how kids learn, but it's how we all learn. And you need attention, You need commitment. You need error feedback. In other words, you try stuff out and you learn and you adapt and you adjust and you get repetitions in, which is like quality attempts, because the more you do it, the more error feedback you get and you get that virtuous circle.
Yeah, I mean, did you read David Epstein's book, Range? I mean, that spoke a lot about...
Yeah, I have it. I'm staring at it in the enormous pile of unread books.
Okay. Yeah, bring it to the top. It's well worth reading.
I've heard nothing but good things about it. Yeah.
Yeah. So, all right. So last thing I wanted to talk about is, in the time we have, is at the end of the book, you say is, all right, we've talked about all this. It doesn't mean that you shouldn't give advice.
Exactly.
It's just you give sort of three rules, and why don't you go through those three rules.
Yeah, so this is, if you hadn't picked this up already, let me say it again really clearly. This is not a book against advice. Advice is critical. It's an everyday leadership action. You need to tell people stuff. We're just trying to slow down the rush to having it be your automatic default response. So you give somebody advice, and here's what's at risk when you give advice. You set somebody up to lose, because if it's bad advice, they either feel they have to take it or they feel they don't have to take it, in which they say to you it's bad advice. And either way, everybody loses, either in the moment because somebody goes, you know, Andy, that's a stupid idea, or mm-hmm. they go, Andy, that's okay, sure, Andy, my boss, I guess I'll do your idea, even though I think it's idiotic. Oh, and look, I fail. So we lose. So my suggestion is that, first of all, wait.
Yes. You know,
so just wait a bit. Ask some questions. Just take you. I'm not asking you to be curious for an hour. I'm going, can you be curious for 120 seconds? Just like 2 or 3 minutes of asking questions before you serve up your gold dust. Then my suggestion is to say, look, when you give advice, make it tentative rather than directive. So I might say, so Andy, look, interesting, and I think I get what the challenge is for you now. Look, I've got some ideas. Look, they might not be right. So you throw something on the table, and what that does is if they go, yeah, Michael, that's not quite right for me. You're like, yeah, I didn't think so. And you're both able to walk away from the advice with a degree of nobody's lost face. You say, mm-hmm. look, this might not work, but let me suggest something. And then the third piece is to say, look, when you finish a conversation or when you've had a piece of advice, you check it out. You go, hey, let me just check. What was most useful for you? What part of that advice really landed with you? Because A, that helps them figure out where the value is in the advice that you've offered. And it also helps you figure out where the value was in the advice that you offered. So you get a little smarter for the next time round.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's to the point you're making, it's okay to say no.
Right.
To advice.
Yeah.
I mean, ultimately, especially in the field, this community that's listening to this isn't, you are responsible. Your boss could give you all the advice in the world, but if you don't make your number, you're the one that pays the price.
Right.
So it is okay to say no.
You know, one of the ways to kind of drill down to the kind of the heart of the work that I do, it would be to try and create adult to adult relationships at work. And, you know, when I say that, often people nod their head and go, well, that sounds very good, very wise. Mm-hmm. And then they're like, but I'm not quite sure what that even means. And what I would say to people is, one definition is adult to adult means being able to ask for what you want, knowing that the answer may be no. Mm-hmm. And feeling like you have the right and sometimes the responsibility to say no to requests and advice and opinion is a very, very powerful place in which to stand. And if you're a person who leads a team, part of your job is to try and build a culture where people can have the confidence to say no to what you bring to them.
Yeah. I mean, otherwise, if you expect people to always say yes, then the arrogance is pretty, pretty blinding.
Right.
At that point, and you really need to read Michael's book.
Somebody once said, if I have a yes man on my team, then one of us is redundant.
Well, that's frightening in two dimensions, because one, that person is assuming they're always right. Yeah. So, yeah. All right. Well, Michael, unfortunately, we've run out of time, but it's been a pleasure to talk to you.
We didn't even get to talk about the other two advice monsters. So let me just say this to people.
Go ahead. Yeah.
If the Advice Monster idea intrigues you, at theadvicetrap.com, so this is the URL of the book, theadvicetrap.com, there's actually a little questionnaire. It's like 20 questions, so maybe 5 minutes, which you can quickly take, and it will actually guide you to which of the three advice monsters, tell it, save it, or control it, is the strongest force for you, plus give you some strategies on how to tame that. So if you'd like to dig a little deeper, then theadvicetrap.com.
Yeah, and I'm just going to tell you, go out and buy the book. And if you haven't read The Coaching Habit, buy that. And they're both the virtue of short, concise books, which that goes high on my list as well.
Thank you, Andy.
Yeah. So I'd encourage people to buy them. Michael, again, pleasure. And look forward to talking to you again soon.
Yeah, it's been a ton of fun. Thank you.
Okay, friends, that's it for this episode. First of all, I want to thank you for taking the time to listen. I'm so grateful for your support of this show. And I want to thank my friend Michael Bungay Stanier for sharing his wisdom with us today. If you enjoy this episode, please subscribe to this podcast, Sales Enablement with Andy Paul, on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to the show. And if you could also leave us a rating or a review and let us know how we're doing, we'd really appreciate it. You can do all that on your phone in less than a minute as soon as this podcast is over. Thank you for your help, and thank you for investing your time to join me today. Until next time, I'm your host, Andy Paul. Good selling, everyone.
Hey, sales strategists. At Revenue.io, we're not just imagining the future of sales, we're building it. We offer the world's most complete platform for revenue teams, and we're featured in the most recent Forrester Waves for both sales engagement and conversation intelligence. With Revenue.io, you can slash call prep time to seconds, guide your reps in real time to have more successful conversations, and after calls, we generate ready-to-send recap emails so sellers can keep deals soaring toward the finish line at light speed. See the future of sales now at Revenue.io.